When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Banging Book Club, the book club where we read books about sex and gender and talk about it. I'm Hannah Whitten.
I'm Lucy Moon.
Lena Norms can't be here because she has a full-time job and is at work. But we are joined by Louise O'Neill.
Hi. Oh, wow. And applause and everything.
Yeah, I could maybe edit in a fake applause. We'll see. Probably yeah. not. So Louise is here to chat to us about her new book, The Surface Breaks, which is reimagining of The Little Mermaid. But we are especially excited to have you here because the first ever book we read for Banging Book Club was asking for it.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
so the book club loves you.
An introduction to a book club about sex and gender.
Yeah. We were like, what have we gotten ourselves in for? So that's the first podcast we ever did.
So this should be the last one, and then you'll just have it like, you know, bookended. Sorry, petition's over now.
Full circle.
We did.
Good times. So we like to do this thing where we give sound reviews for books.
Okay.
Because it's a podcast, so it's like audio reviews. Would you care to give us a sound review of you reviewing your experience of writing this book?
I have no idea what I'm going to do for this. What?
So my sound review for The Surface Breaks would be... Ooh.
Oh my god. And like you sound reviewed your own book when it came out.
Oh,
as well,
yeah,
right?
It sounded but like giving birth.
Yeah, the writing process.
I have no idea how I'm going to do this. Can one of you do it for me instead? Look, you did a great one there, so maybe we'll just leave it at that.
If I had written this book, I would imagine it would have been like, like a really fun time. Was it a fun time?
It was a fun time.
There we go, nailed it.
Okay, that is amazing. I'm going to be thinking about it all night going, what would I have done?
Can you send us like a voice note version?
Yeah, okay, yes, I will. If it comes to me, I'll be like sending a voice note.
Amazing. do you want to tell us a little bit about what The Surface Breaks is about?
Yeah, absolutely. The Surface Breaks is about a little mermaid called Gaia, and she lives deep under the sea off the Irish coast in a sea kingdom that is run by her father, who is the sea king. And Gaia feels very trapped. She feels trapped by, I think, the societal expectations that, you know, of the sea kingdom, by her overbearing father, by this engagement to a man that she doesn't love. Mm-hmm. So on her 15th birthday, when she's allowed to go to the surface for the first time, and she catches a glimpse of a very young, handsome young man.
Oliver.
Oliver. Mm-hmm. And she thinks that she falls in love with him, but I really think that she sees him as an escape route in a lot of ways. And the book is really about, I think, what lengths will Gaia go to gain the freedom that she so desperately wants.
And there's also what I liked about it, the mystery element of Gaia's mother as well. I was like, oh, this is some kind of like mystery Sherlock Holmes, like detective story as well.
Well, it's really interesting with fairy tales because there is often a trope of like the motherless princess. And a lot of the times it's...
Or the evil... Oh, no, you're right.
Yeah.
The stepmothers.
Yes. And it's a really interesting trope if you look at it, because it's just so inherently sexist, because it sort of is the idea of like the good woman, the bad woman, you know, the good girl, the bad girl. So it's like, you know, the dead perfect mother and then the evil stepmother. So I wanted to sort of play around with the trope of the dead mother, because she's not really mentioned in the original fairy tale. Actually, she's not mentioned at all. It's just as if
Because in the Disney film, she's not
yeah.
a thing at all.
No,
it's
not
just
at
like
all.
She has a dad, she doesn't have a mum, like not mentioned.
Exactly. It's just, you know, magically kind yeah. of, you know, I don't know how they were conceived, but there's no mention of a mother. So I don't know, I just thought I was really interested in that idea. And I mm-hmm. also thought that if you were a young woman who had never known their mother, I think that would be a really huge factor in your life and sort of shaping your personality and the way that you saw the world. And I just thought it would seem really odd if I didn't address it in my retelling. So as you said, that's a pretty important mm-hmm. plot line running through the book.
So why The Little Mermaid?
I was literally yeah. about to ask this. Someone called...
And what did they ask?
Layla? No. Petra, sorry Petra, yeah. on Twitter was like, why The Little Mermaid over any other fairy tale?
Well, I suppose firstly, what happened was, it was the summer of 2016 when Lauren Fortune, who is the editorial director here at Scholastic, mm-hmm. actually approached me and said she wanted to commission me to do a feminist retelling of The Little Mermaid. And I probably should have said no, because I was like knee deep in writing Alma's Love, which is my first novel for adults, which came out 2 months ago.
Yeah, two Louise O'Neill books in one year.
I'm so tired.
Two books in 2 months.
It's ridiculous. It was ridiculous. But anyway, it's fine. I'm going to survive. I'm still alive. It's grand. But I think once she said The Little Mermaid, I just couldn't say no, because I was obsessed with that story. You know, I grew up on Inchinani Beach, and I was really fascinated by the water. Like my mom said, whenever I was upset or if I was crying or, you know, in a bad mood, that if she put me in a bath, I would sort of instantly be soothed. And because we grew up like right on the beach, I always just had this real just sense of fascination with the water. And then when the Disney version of The Little Mermaid came out, I was 4 at the time, so I think it was prime age to just like for that.
I love the Disney version.
I do too. And I think because like it was the first Disney princess in 30 years when that was released in 89.
Because it's the start of the Renaissance Disney time.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Was that all before that was kind of like Jungle Book and Pinocchio? And
the princesses before Ariel
were Snow White and
Sleeping
Cinderella.
Beauty.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then Ariel kicked off
the new
like Belle,
the new wave.
The new
second
wave
gen.
Of so
new
yeah.
Wave
so I think it's, you know, especially like it was 1989. So you're also talking about like massive marketing, and you know. So there was just I think an entire generation of young women, sort of late 20s, early 30s now, that she was. Just we were all obsessed with her. I think mm-hmm. we all wanted to be Ariel. And it was really as a teenager, I think. When I started to identify as a feminist, and I read Angela Carter, The Bloody Chamber.
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So that's like a very gory retelling of some fairy tales, for those who don't know.
Yes,
yeah.
It's very bleak, very dark, but just beautifully twisted. It's just such mm-hmm. a great book. And I suppose that was the first time that I really began to think about fairy tales in that light, you know, that some
yeah.
of them had like really odd
because
like, gender politics.
The Surface Breaks is more a retelling of the original Hans Christian
yes.
Andersen, which
yes.
is dark.
Yes, it is. And
yeah.
I think that was when I first, when I went back to revisit it, I kind of knew, talking to Lauren, that it was going to be, you know, a retelling more of the original fairy tale rather than the Disney version.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I reread it, and I hadn't read it in ages. I couldn't believe how dark it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when she goes to, when the Little Mermaid goes to the sea witch and she asks her for this magic potion to transform her tail into legs, and the witch asks for her voice in return, and the Little Mermaid says, well, how am I going to make the prince fall in love with me? And the witch says, well, you know, you have your lovely form. So it's like basically
yeah.
you have your body.
Oh, dear.
Sure, who cares about anything else? So I was like, God, that's grim. And then I think I had forgotten as well about the violence of when, you know, she, when her, like when her tail does, I suppose, hew into two legs, just how painful it is for her on the earth, you know, that she feels
mm-hmm.
as if like she's walking on broken glass, and you know, there's daggers stabbing up through her
and
feet.
And your description of the deterioration of her human feet was like, I was like, oh, at some points, but because I was wondering what age this book is for, because I imagine it's YA.
Yes,
probably
it is YA.
It
yeah.
is YA. Okay, because there are so many elements of it. I'm like, oh, this is YA, like this nice little innocent bits. It's a fairy tale, and I'm like, oh god, like,
yeah. Well, it's
like,
me, so
yeah.
like it has to be like sort of dark. And it's really funny that you say
yeah.
that, because whenever anyone asks, I'm like, oh, this is a much younger book than all the others. I think 12 or 13 year olds could read this, so maybe not.
But I think there are bits of it that seem very young.
Yes.
That I felt like, oh, maybe I'm a bit too old to be reading this. But then some of the brutality of it, like the politics, but also the physical brutality, I was like, this is pretty heavy.
Yes, yeah. But then I suppose, as I said, it was all kind of derived from the original fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, after my dad read it, because he, I suppose, only remembered the Disney version as well. And he also asked, he was like, can I have your copy of the original fairy tale? Because he said he couldn't remember, I suppose, how violent some of that was. So I thought it was important to deal with that, because I suppose the messaging is so incredibly strange, especially for young children. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like she gives up her voice. She literally silences herself in order to be in a relationship, and then she mutilates her body so that a man that she barely knows will find her attractive. It's really messed up, you know?
But Gaia very much is justifying it all to herself, and the book is in her head.
Yeah.
So do you, in terms of what you're imagining the reader's journey, are you imagining that the reader is like, Gaia, you idiot, like, what are you doing? Yeah. Or almost going along with her?
I think it depends. I think it depends on what age the reader is, or sort of their level, not even necessarily age, but maybe level of maturity. It was interesting in some of the edits, because there were some notes about making maybe it slightly more romantic. And I struggled slightly with that. I'm like, how do I do that though? I don't know.
Because was it a conscious choice as well to have Gaia being 15 and Oliver 21? Like that age gap as well.
Yeah, it's creepy. Yeah, it is very creepy.
Because you're almost not rooting for it at all, because you're like, that's illegal.
Yeah.
Like, it's just straight up not cool.
Oh God, Oliver.
Oliver's going to go to jail.
I know. And to be fair, he's really not interested at all. Not really. Like, you know, I feel really sorry for him, because I suppose it's, again, you know, which I've tried to do in other books, is to explore how the patriarchy affects, you know, both young women and young men, mm-hmm. because he is grieving and doesn't have the space or even really the vocabulary with which to express that, because, you know, it's not encouraged for young men to cry or be vulnerable or, you know, express their emotions in that way. And I really wanted to sort of look at that as well, that he is, you know, he's a victim of the patriarchy just as much as Gaia is, really, in some ways.
Yeah, and I think him struggling with those things as well impacts the women in his life, especially his mother, who then, again, another victim of the patriarchy.
Yes, I love her, though.
She's great.
Yeah, she is.
Her and the sea witch just need to, like, hang out. They need to, the two of them, they're going to be a spin-off. Book.
Yes, oh my God, I would love that. Because I suppose I really just wanted to represent two women who refused to conform. And I think how they are both punished in their own way for actually wanting to live life on their own terms, which I think is something that a lot of women struggle with.
Because one thing I've seen online a lot recently is a lot of Ursula, like in the Disney film, Ursula, like body positive, fat pride and stuff. Yeah. And I think that was definitely in this book as well. Yes. It's like the fact that the sea witch or Ursula is like the ultimate feminist icon.
Yeah, I love her.
And she has like a feminist commune. The Rusalkas?
Yeah, Rusalkas, yeah.
Tell us a bit about them. And were they an invention of yours, or are they
else? It's, okay. I did a lot of research into mermaid mythology, and I was really interested by the idea of them, because it's in sort of Russian and Slavic mythology, they have long green hair, and they're these girls that, which I thought was really interesting, was the origin of the story, that it tends to be women who have been jilted at the altar, or women who have been, you know, who died in childbirth, or women who, you know, so had quite tragic ends. And I think I really started thinking about that. And I just thought, I suppose for me in an Irish context, it felt like I could kind of weave in certain aspects of Irish history around the way that women have been treated in our history. You know, the way the church and the state have conspired to police women's bodies, particularly the fact that we don't have access at the moment. Well, hopefully that'll change.
Yeah.
At the end of this
repeal
month.
Repeal the eighth.
But, you know, I suppose looking at, let's say, the Magdalen laundries or the mother and baby homes, where unmarried women were basically thrown into these homes that were run by the Catholic Church and put into basically like enforced slavery. And then their babies taken from them and sold kind of to the highest bidder.
But then the sea witch takes them in.
Yes, exactly. Which is why I really wanted to reclaim the sea witch as well. And you're right, because it's funny, as a child watching it, I remember being like, oh, Ursula's so mean. Mm-hmm. And then as an adult, you're like, oh my God, Ursula's such a badass. And she looks so cool and like the lipstick. And, you know, I just wanted, again, I think the way that we demonize, as I said, women who, you know, want to live life on their own terms. And particularly, I suppose, in fairy tales, that kind of trope of the evil witch is actually really sexist and ageist when you look at it. You know, if you think of the witch hunts in sort of the 16th and the 17th centuries, most of the time those were just women who didn't want to, you know, comply with patriarchal religions. They wanted to, like, live independently, and they were, you know, burned at the stake for it. And also, it's just this idea that as a woman ages, that the only thing that she can do is become really, like, bitter and jealous of younger women and their beauty, and, like, live in a cabin at the edge, you know, at the edge of the forest or whatever. So it just, to me, felt really reductive, and I wanted my sea witch to be much more complex than that. And she's great. I had so much fun writing her.
Yeah, she was pretty cool. I just really need to know the answer to this, which is something that the Sea King says to Gaia, and I'm like, is this a Donald Trump reference? Have you ever asked this before?
I have. The Sea King, I'm afraid to say it on I'm like, no, of course not.
So the Sea King basically says about his own daughter, if she wasn't mine, I'd marry her. Which sounds very similar to something Donald Trump said about his daughter,
I mean,
Ivanka.
You're drawing similarities there now. I admit it to nothing. I think, you know, I suppose the thing about rewriting a fairy tale is that before I started, I was like, what do I want to say with this, you know? And obviously, you know, feminism is a really important part of just my personality and who I am and how I identify. But I think I have been really dismayed, I suppose, looking at world politics and, you know, obviously, you know, Brexit here and Trump in the States, and kind of the rise of very right-wing politics across Europe. And I just wanted to look, I suppose, at how we have allowed ourselves to become divided in lots of ways, you know, that we other people that aren't like us, whether that's, you know, gender or sexuality, yeah, exactly, or, you know, race. And I just think that I wanted to, I suppose, emphasize a message of diversity and inclusivity. And obviously, I was drawing inspiration from recent events. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Great answer.
Yeah, he's quite litigious, I'm scared.
It's true.
I doubt he cares about what I do, but, you know, you never know.
That's what I love about, like, the Easter eggs of when someone wrote a particular novel, is like the cultural commentary, even when it's really subtle.
Yeah.
I just think that's, like, my favourite part of it. Layla asks on Twitter, does your choice to retell The Little Mermaid mean that you dislike the original by default? Ooh. And which did you pull most inspiration from, which we've kind of already answered, the traditional story or the Disney version?
Yes. Well, I definitely took more inspiration from the traditional version. No, it doesn't mean I hate it. I still really love the Disney version. I love the music. Ariel is just one of, you know, I'm like, have red hair, and, you know, basically, like, I was like, I am Ariel, you know, that, anyway, yeah. And also I think I really identified with her, because I know when I was a child, I always had this sense of sort of feeling like I was different or feeling like I didn't really belong. And I think because of the way that Ariel just wanted more for herself, I suppose, than the world around her thought that she was capable of, that was something that I always really identified.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, no, I'm not saying, you know, you don't have to, like, I think that's unfair, because I think these are books and these are movies that are part of our childhood, and have sort of, you know, part of our psyche in a lot of ways. But I think it's always worth looking at things that we consumed when we were younger with a more critical eye,
yeah.
Because you can really start to see, I wonder how this affected me, or how this affected my thought processes. Because I know, obviously, as I said, as a teenager, looking back at it and going, oh, this is really problematic, particularly how she, I suppose, you know, wants to change her body. And obviously, as someone who had, you know, anorexia, bulimia, like, for most of my adolescence, you know, you do start to wonder, well, I wonder what impact that kind of social messaging had on me. Because, you know, I was that, and it was, you know, Sweet Valley High, and trying to think, you know, Barbies, and, you know, there's certain things that I was very drawn to, and you do wonder, I suppose, about how that shapes your idea of what women are supposed to look like, and body image and things like that. So I think it's, I think it's always worth looking at something with a more critical eye, but you don't have to decide that, you know, you hate it, unless it's a Woody Allen film and you're cancelled.
Oh, God.
Cancelled.
The saddest thing. That actually ties into one of Lena's questions. Mm-hmm. So Lena, our other co-host.
I'm very sad we don't get to meet her.
Yeah, sadly, has a full-time job. What's that?
My God.
What is that?
Yeah.
She sent us a bunch of questions, and she said, should we still tell the original Little Mermaid story to children and or show them the Disney film?
I don't know.
What's the rules there?
I know. I mean, to be honest, I don't have children.
You do, you parents.
Yeah. And I really, I'm so loath to, because I have friends who have small children now, and it just looks so tough. And it feels like they get kind of like unsolicited advice from every you know, which way, or people saying, oh, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, and it looks really exhausting. So I think it's really up to the parents themselves, because I think if you're a woman and you are really feminist and you are really interested in these ideas, maybe you'll decide, actually, this isn't something that I would like to show my daughter. But I know my best friend, who, you know, I'm godmother to her son, who's only a year, he's so cute, his name is George, actually, so one of the characters in the book is named after him.
He's the good one.
I wanted to give like a representation of masculinity that like didn't feel limiting, that, you know, he's very sensitive and he's quite gentle, and I just wanted like that, just for my George, to sort of see that, you know, he can be whatever he wants to be, that he doesn't have to conform to this idea of hyper-masculinity. He'll probably never read the book, but anyway, it's there anyway, George. But her little girl, Isabel, the last time I was in the house, and I was telling her about The Little Mermaid, she's like, oh, I have that book. You know, she had this beautiful, God, the illustrations were absolutely stunning. And I'm not going to turn around to my best friend and say, you shouldn't be letting her read that. It's like, because she's not my daughter, it's not up to me. So I think it's really about the sensibilities of the parents involved, and, you know, what, you know, some people are more conscious of it and some people don't really maybe care as much.
Yeah. Another question from, which I also was wondering, from Beth, is the cover is gorgeous but very different from your other books.
Yes.
How did you find the inspiration for it? What drew you to this particular cover design, and what was the process?
Well, actually, like, the thing is that I don't have that much to do with the covers. Like, they will come, they'll come to me with you know, an idea or sort of a rough kind of, you know, proof of it. And then I have veto, but like, I'm not really involved in the actual development of it. So I know, obviously, because the rest of my books are with a different publisher, and they're with Quercus and River Run. So when they're choosing a cover, it's very much like, well, what is the Louise O'Neill brand? You know, that sort of way. Yeah. So like the YA books had kind of a similar, you know, there was doll parts. And then when they republished those as adult editions, it was, you know, usually tends to be sort of an up close of a woman's face.
Almost
and Almost Love has
like that
as well.
Yeah.
So with this book, obviously, it's, you know, it's a different publisher. So they're not as concerned maybe about kind of keeping in line with that branding. So they sent me through an original, the first one, which was a different artist. And I just didn't feel like it fit. It was, you know, beautiful, but it just didn't really fit with, I think, the story. So then when they came back to me with this, I was absolutely and utterly just stunned by it.
It's beautiful.
And I feel comfortable saying that because I had nothing to do with it, so I can say it's so stunning.
It's like one of those books that you're just always going to keep on your shelf.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I agree. And it's a Colombian artist called Paula Escobar. And I keep saying Pablo Escobar. Yeah. I didn't people really? Interesting. But he's just multi-talented.
Who knew?
Exactly. But no, it's really beautiful. And I loved because, you know, there's so much in it, you know, because when they were going through it, and there's obviously, you know,
the hair and the daggers.
And, you know, the foil. Mm-hmm. It's so funny, before you get published, you never really think about this. And then they're like, we're putting foil on the cover.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. God, so, you know, you've made it.
Yeah, exactly. foil. And I love the, on the hardback, on the inside, it's got mermaid
scales.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm going to have to look it up after we finish recording.
It is beautiful. So on Instagram, Rosalind Pearl asked, if you could be a mermaid for a day, what would you be most excited to do?
Oh,
I love this question.
That's such a, like, what's it called, TRL question.
Yes. I think, you know what, I suppose when I was a child and I would swim constantly, it used to really frustrate me that I couldn't breathe underwater. Do you know that mm-hmm. I couldn't just, because I wanted to dive under there and spend the rest of my life there. And so I think it would just be being able to explore, I suppose, you know, really deep underneath the surface. And I was going to say go see the coral reef, but apparently that is not much to look at anymore because humans are trash and they've destroyed it.
Yeah. Who's watched Blue Planet?
Yeah. Very disturbing.
The thing about being a mermaid or like being able to swim underwater, the thing that really excites me about that is that it would feel like you're flying. It's the closest you'd get to actually
feel like you're flying. And also, I obviously have really, really, really long hair.
Your hair would look amazing
so
on your water.
So this would be excellent. Really long, really thick hair. Oh. The dream. It's like I've had like incredibly expensive hair extensions put in. So yeah, that would be the other thing that I will just be really looking forward to.
Do you know what I discovered recently is that actually it's well easier to open your eyes in seawater than it is in swimming pool water. Yeah, I've always avoided opening my eyes in the sea because I'm like, oh, the salt will stink. But no, you can see so clearly. It's beautiful.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, the pool that I go to at home, it's right on the beach and it's heated seawater that they use in the pool. So like the chlorine is like really, really low. So
that sounds amazing.
I'm allergic to chlorine as well. I get in swimming pools and I'm just like, hit you. I'm sneezing.
Okay, you must come to my swimming pool.
I'll come to your swimming pool. I need to do a proper trip to Ireland as well.
Oh, you do. Absolutely. Like because the countryside is so stunning. I always feel with probably this Dublin's great, but you know it is kind of like any European city. Mm-hmm. I think you have to get outside to see like the full splendor of the nature.
Speaking of Ireland, you said that this book is set off the Irish coast underwater, so in the Sea Kingdom, but then obviously once Gaia gets on land, is that supposed to be Ireland or is it really vague? Because I also couldn't tell what time it was set in.
I wanted it to be as timeless and as universal as possible.
Okay,
I didn't want them to have
mobile phones.
Yes, you know, things like that. I just thought that would just seem really anachronistic. So I just wanted, because that's the whole point of fairy tales, that's why they're so enduring, is because there is a really timeless element to them in general.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to date it in any way because I wanted it to be quite close to the original fairy tale. So it is obviously, it feels much more modern in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to specify a place. I didn't want to specify a time. I also think that gives the reader more space to insert themselves in the narrative, you know, particularly when it's being read abroad, and that there isn't any sort of really specific time or place, so it could be anywhere, you know.
Yeah, I think especially it could be anywhere because you make a point of having the humans being of loads of different races as well, because Gaia's in the Sea Kingdom, the Sea King is like, everyone must look a certain way, let's banish all of the undesirables. And then she goes on land, she's like, oh, there are people different coloured skin, what?
And again, that was really important because, you know, I suppose it's funny, when I was younger, and I remember having this conversation with someone before, like I often felt like I didn't, you know, I was looking at pictures and magazines and things like that, a very, you know, blonde, tanned, blue-eyed women, and I remember feeling like, oh god, well I can't be beautiful unless I look like that. And the thing is that I'm 5'9" and you know I'm I'm a relatively thin woman, so like I have like
did you hear that? Did the mic pick up the absolute storm that is happening outside right now?
I thought, are any of those windows open?
So it just suddenly started getting worse. I'm sick.
I'm not going outside, we're staying inside forever.
Yeah, I just suddenly saw the weather turn and I was like, no, I'm going mad. And then I just done this.
I'm going to get the windows open because that was really loud.
Anyway, right, sorry.
You were mid-sentence and I'm not sure what it was.
I'll start that over. I said, when I was a teenager and, you know, watching movies or watching TV shows or looking at magazines, and it was always, you know, these blonde and blue-eyed and, you know, tanned women. And I remember feeling as if, well, I can't be beautiful unless I'm, you know, tall and blonde and blue-eyed. And the thing is that, you know, I'm also, I am tall, I am, you know, thin, I am a white woman. So in general, I suppose there are certain aspects of that I am closer maybe than, you know, than other people. And so when I was in New York, one of my best friends there was Korean-American. And we just started talking about it. And she was like, yeah, but how would you have felt if, you know, you never saw anyone that looked like you? You know, if you opened up a magazine, you know, that you opened up a magazine, you never saw a face that looked like yours. You never saw a face on television that looked like yours, unless it was like a real stereotype. And certainly not as portrayed as someone who is attractive or someone who is beautiful. It really made me feel incredibly spoiled and quite brattish. Mm-hmm. And really, I think, made me confront my own, like, white privilege. And I think what was important for me in this book, not to kind of, I suppose, dwell on the point, but that you know, the most beautiful woman in the book is of Indian descent, you know, that the most powerful family in the book are black, you know, so that it's just, I think it's really about representation and about that we see, you know, the people of colour in that light. So I think that's important anyway, you know.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. I wanted to ask, do you think Gaia is a good role model?
Oh, God. I'm not sure. I don't know if I would ever be really that interested in writing a character and saying that I think this person this character is a role model. Because I'm not sure. Firstly, I'm not really sure if I agree with the idea of role models in general, because I get that a lot where people are like, oh, you're such a role model. And I'm like, I just don't want that responsibility.
So I get that a lot too. But the way I think of it is, it's kind of not up to us. If someone sees us as a role model,
yes,
then you,
but
then you
are.
But you
have to be allowed space, I think, to make mistakes.
No, yeah,
100%. And to be flawed and to be human. And sometimes I think if you have the label of a role model, it doesn't give you much space to do any of that. So I think that I'm more interested with the characters in my book in making them very real and very authentic. And I suppose certainly as I was as a teenage girl, you know, a little bit confused and not really sure, you know, what's going on or what they're doing. And I think that's maybe more important than being a role model. So just being human.
Yeah. Or a mermaid.
Or a mermaid, exactly. Either or.
Marion asks, what message would you like readers to leave with after finishing the book?
Yeah, well, I think I've probably answered that a little bit, but, you know, it is about diversity, inclusivity. And also, I think, for young women to realise that, or not even realise, because it's not that we don't have voices, it's just so often that we're silenced. And I think it's really important for young women because to realise that their voices are really important, to realise how important it is to speak up and to speak out, particularly at the time that we're at, because I think there is just no place for complacency anymore, because that time has passed, and there is really urgent political issues that need to be addressed. And I think that young women are such an incredibly powerful force. You know, people make fun of young women. Like, teenage girls made the Beatles the biggest band in the world, you know? Like, they have serious power. And I think it's really just about listening to them, and so that they feel empowered to use their voices, and just to refuse to shut up and to refuse to be silenced.
And on that, how was it writing half of the book where your main character couldn't speak?
So hard. So hard. And it was really funny because I hadn't even thought about it. Yeah. And then it was like, you know, she takes the potion and I'm about to go, you know, Gaia said, and I was like, oh no. Oh shit. So there was a lot of italics after that. It was like, you know, I think and I thought, and I was like, oh, this is going to be really tough. But
Yeah, it was fine. It was just really funny that I hadn't actually thought about it until
like
I was
practicality.
Yeah, like genuinely until I was midway through. And
it's
I was
like, oh, what about dialogue? It's yes. Just a lot of people talking at her.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But then I suppose kind of a lot of ways, sometimes that can feel that is like, well, what my memory of being a teenage girl was as well, was being talked at and actually not being listened to all that much, or you know, being looked at and not being listened to all that much. So I thought that that was kind of an interesting parallel to draw between Gaia and between a lot of maybe what you know, contemporary teenage girls are experiencing.
Yeah. And finally, another question from our dear Lena. Would you consider retelling any other fairy tale in the future?
I had so much fun with this.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny because with the other three books, they took a lot out of me. Do you know, it felt like I was kind of like carving something out of myself and then, you know, just like throwing it on the page. And you know, I was exhausted after each of them. And with, I finished the first draft of Almost Love on a Thursday. I gave myself the Friday off because it was my birthday. so wild. And then I started the first draft of The Surface Breaks on the Monday. And I was writing this while I was simultaneously editing Almost Love.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, but you know what? It was funny because the edit of Almost Love was really tricky. And this just felt like the most glorious escape, you know, that I could just go into it and really let, because this was, I had the narrative framework in which to write.
And
so
you can just kind of go to town around that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, just let my imagination run wild. So I really, really enjoyed it. So I would love to do more retellings. I mean, it's not in the cards at the moment because I have to deliver, let's say, my next adult novel for Quirkus. But if someone, I know.
What would be your, like, number one fairy tale to retell again?
I was gonna say maybe Beauty and the Beast, just because I mean it's a story about Stockholm syndrome
and Nightingale syndrome.
Yes, it's so odd, and bestiality, like let's not, you know, ignore that. So it's just a really, like, and I think Emma Watson's amazing, but I'm like, I don't know if
that wasn't a retelling. That was just a repeat.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that one. But there's loads. Oh my God, there's loads. There's so many that I think I could do a really good job on. But I think actually I just really, if there was two Disney movies, maybe it's just because of my age as well, because I was seven when Beauty and the Beast came out. But I think the two of those, particularly Ariel and Belle, because Belle was so bookish, you know, that sort of way. So I think there's like a lot of young women who would have also identified with that. So maybe the two of them, maybe that'll be my next one.
Exciting.
You heard it here first
on
the Banging Book Club.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dear bangers, hopefully we've caught your interest and you should go and get The Surface Breaks.
Yes, thank
and
you.
And read it. It is out now and it is wonderful.
Oh, thank
you. I really loved it.
Oh, thank you.
I actually read it whilst I was, started reading it when I was going to Dublin for the day.
Yes.
And what's the, please pronounce it for me, the name of Gaia's mum?
Oh, Murren.
Murren.
Yeah.
Murren.
Murren.
I then met a girl that day with that name.
No way! You were like, okay, tell me how you pronounce this.
And I was just like, I'm reading this book at the moment and your name's in it.
There's quite a few Irish names in there. I just like to torment my English agent who gets really, she's like, how do I, and I'm like, that's not how you pronounce it. And then I laugh at her and she feels quite hurt. But that's just how I roll, so.
Good work.
Yeah, thank you.
Where can people follow you online?
Sure. Well, I'm on Twitter at O'Neilo. That's three L's because there's a lovely guy in Florida called Orlando who people keep tweeting abuse at him. And he's very nice. He's like, I don't think you're looking for me. So I think Twitter is probably, or Instagram. I'm on that as well at O'Neil Lou. And that's also got three L's. So either or.
So just remember the three L's.
Yes.
Thanks for listening. You can also follow Banging Book Club on Twitter and Instagram at Banging Book Club. And would you have sex with this book? That's what we always ask
having
as well.
Having not read it yet, but having read your other stuff, yes.
I think I would too. But maybe once Guy like turns 16.
Yeah,
very much consensual sex. Please.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank
Bye.
You. Would I have sex with this book?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.